The 16th chapter of Matthew ends with Jesus talking about the cross, calling us to the cross. If we are going to follow Him, He declared, we need to deny ourselves and take up the cross. He promises that those who lose their life will find it, whereas those who live for themselves will miss what life is all about, both presently and eternally. And then he ends the chapter by saying that the result of the cross is the manifestation of glory. For the Son of Man, verse 27, shall come in the glory of his Father with his angels, and he shall reward every man according to his works. Truly or verily I say unto you, there be some standing here which shall not taste of death till they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. So the cross leads to the crown. The gruel of the cross leads to the glory of the kingdom. And then he says, some of you, to his disciples who are standing here, are going to see that day coming before you die. You're going to see the kingdom. Now, the question is, was Jesus mistaken here? Did these disciples see the coming of the kingdom? Did they see the glory of the kingdom? There have been those who suggest that Jesus was amiss, that it didn't come to pass in the way that he thought it would. And some have said that this proves that Jesus actually was fallible. Of course, that's blasphemy. For you see, chapter 17, as we go into the next chapter, shows that they did indeed, some who were standing there, see the glory of the kingdom. We read, after 6 days, Jesus taketh Peter, James, and John his brother, and bringeth them up into a high mountain apart. Jesus once again calling his disciples apart. I have said before, and I firmly believe it, that if we don't come apart, we'll fall apart. You need to get away. I need to get away from the pressures, from the trials, from the daily routineness of life, and get away into a high mountain where we might be apart with Jesus, lest we fall apart in the pressures and troubles of the world. And so Jesus took 3 of his disciples, Peter, James, and John. Now, this was evidently the inner circle of the disciples. 3 times Jesus took Peter, James, and John specifically, apart from the others, where he ministered with them and to them in a very definite, very special way. It interests me that in those 3 occasions, all 3 of those occasions dealt with death. The first time Jesus called Peter, James, and John apart, he took Peter, James, and John only into the house of Jairus, where Jairus' daughter had died. You recall the story. How that ruler of the synagogue, Jairus, 12 years old was his daughter, and he came seeking Jesus for help because she was sick. When they got there, she had died. And Jesus said, don't worry, she's simply sleeping. And they mocked him. They laughed at him. And Jesus put out the mockers. That's always a key, if we're going to see the Lord minister to us personally, is to drive out the mockers in our own heart. Those that say, oh, a miracle isn't going to happen, that you really aren't going to see God's work in your life or through your life. Put out the mockers. And then Jesus took Peter, James, and John, and they went in, and Jesus resurrected that little girl from the dead. So in that instance, Jesus is showing that he is victorious over death. Then, on a second occasion, Jesus took Peter, James, and John into a garden called Gethsemane, hours before Jesus was to be crucified on the cross at Calvary. And there he said to these three men, "Pray with me." And of course, you know the story, how they fell asleep. Even as Jesus was in such need, he continued to pray while they were sleeping. But in so doing, calling Peter, James, and John, Jesus was showing them not victory over death, but submission to death. For he prayed there in the Garden of Gethsemane, "Father, if it be possible, let this cup of death pass from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but thy will be done." Jesus was submitted to death. So we see him taking this inner circle, these three special ones, Peter, James, and John, showing them victory over death in the house of Jairus, submission to death there in the Garden of Gethsemane, and here in Matthew 17, the third time, a third instance where these three are called out, we are going to see them understand that Jesus is glorified in death. The transfiguration, the glorification, the shining of Jesus. These three are going to see him talking with Moses and Elijah. And Luke's gospel tells us that they were talking to Jesus about his death. What's he showing them? He already showed them he was victorious over death, that he was submitted to death. He would show them that as he prayed with them in Gethsemane. And now, he is showing them that he will be glorified in death. That death is not something to be feared, but rather, those who bear the cross and enter into the kingdom, there shall be a glorious transfiguration, transformation, a glowing, a shining. I point this out to you, because Peter, James, and John needed these special times of instruction concerning death. Why? James would be the first disciple who was put to death. James was the first one to die, a martyr, at the hands of persecutor when they sawed him in half long ways. He died a very terrible, very painful, very brutal death. No wonder Jesus took James and allowed in these three instances for him to have a special time of instruction concerning death. For James would be the first of the disciples to die. John, he was the last of the disciples to die. Oh, they tried to kill him, Nero did. They placed him into a cauldron of boiling oil. They hoped that he would sizzle. Kentucky Fried Apostle. But you know, John didn't die. And so Nero, not knowing what else to do, banished him to an island called Patmos, a rocky, rugged, seemingly God-forsaken island. And here, a 90-year-old man, John the Apostle, alone, isolated, in conditions that were brutal, and yet it was there, as you know, that he had revelation. The book of Revelation was given to John at that time. Peter? He was the first one that Jesus said specifically, "Peter, they're going to kill you." There in John chapter 21, you might recall the story how Jesus said, "Peter, they're going to stretch out your hands," signifying crucifixion, "and they are going to carry you where you don't want to go." Indeed, they would do just that. Peter would be crucified upside down. And Jesus was telling Peter first and foremost about his death. Now, Peter, who was standing next to John at that time, when he heard those words, said, "What shall this man do? What about John?" And Jesus said, "Peter, what is that to thee? You follow me. Don't worry about John. I'm talking to you about what's coming in your life." So these three apostles, this inner circle, if you would, each would have a very real encounter with unique death. James the first to die brutally, John the last to die, and Peter the first to be told that he was going to die, crucified. It encourages my heart, for you see, you too will receive special revelation and instruction concerning what the Lord sees is ahead in your life. He gives you special understandings. He prepares you for what He sees coming. Bible studies, radio programs, friends, books. I don't know how He'll do it, but in some way He'll prepare you. And it's amazing to me how I'll study something or hear something, and sure enough, a week later, man, here it is. And I was so glad I heard that message or got that rap, because I need it. And it saw me through in a beautiful way. Well, these three, this inner circle, prepared by the Lord, because they would have their own special encounter with death. And as He took them, verse 2, He was transfigured, or metamorphosized in the Greek. He was metamorphosized. The same word that describes what a butterfly does when a butterfly goes into a cocoon. Did you know when a butterfly goes into a cocoon and the metamorphosis takes place? Well, not a butterfly. A caterpillar goes into the cocoon, and a butterfly emerges from the cocoon. Did you know that the caterpillar actually liquefies totally inside the cocoon? If you take that cocoon and split it open, it just comes pouring out. It's liquid inside. It seems hopeless, man. I mean, there's no way that poor caterpillar liquefied inside of there, and suddenly a miracle begins to happen called the metamorphosis, or He is transfigured, the same word that is used here. Now we are going to see Jesus being transfigured, if you would. A change is going to be happening. He was transfigured before them like a caterpillar being transfigured or transformed or metamorphosized into a butterfly. What happened with Jesus? His face did shine as the sun, and His raiment was made white as the light. He starts shining. This really happened. We're not talking fairy tale. We're talking reality. He suddenly metamorphosized. He starts glowing and shining. Now, Moses, interestingly enough, when he was on the mountain, not this mount, Mount Hermon, but Mount Sinai, where he was receiving the law, when he came down, he was also glowing, wasn't he? But do you recall the story, how that glow began to dim as time went on? Because it wasn't his glow. He was simply reflecting the fact that he was in the presence of God, and he was shining with that reflected glory. What did he do? Old Mo took a veil and put it over his face. Seemingly, when you read the Old Testament, because he didn't want the people to be blown away by his shining, but the New Testament tells us what was happening in reality. He didn't want the people to see that glow diminishing. So he put this veil over his face, and then he would go back up in the presence of God and get recharged, and then come down again. But Moses, who represented the law, the glory was a fading glory, and it was a reflected glory. Here, Jesus, who is not law, but even as John declared, Moses, by Moses came the law, but by Jesus came what? Grace and truth. It's not reflected glory. It's radiated glory. It's coming from Him, not simply being reflected from Him, but it's innately shining forth. Now catch the scene. This is powerful. The deity of Jesus was shining through His humanity, and suddenly He starts glowing. This tells me something. That whatever is inside of a person will eventually come shining out from that person. If it's good stuff, you'll glow goodly. If it's dark stuff that's inside of you, that's going to manifest itself eventually. Whatever is really going on in your heart is eventually going to come out. What was in Jesus? Deity, man. Glory. Light. And suddenly on Mount Hermon, He starts glowing, shining, transformed. And behold, verse 3, there appeared unto them Moses and Elijah talking with Him. Luke again tells us they were talking with Him about His upcoming death. Then answered Peter and said unto Jesus, Lord, it is good for us to be here. True. I mean, days earlier, Jesus was talking about the cross and death and crucifixion. And Peter said, Lord, be it far from thee. This shall not be. Peter wasn't into talking about the cross and crucifixion. But now that he sees the glory and the light and the transfiguration, he says, oh, wow, it's good that we're here. He's into that. If thou wilt, verse 4, let us make here three tabernacles, one for thee, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. Let's build three booths. Three memorials, if you would, for this great mountaintop experience. Lord, it's great what's happening. You're shining. You're glowing. Wow. Moses represents, of course, the law. Elijah represents the prophets. And Peter realizes this is heavy. I mean, here is Moses and Elijah with our leader, Jesus. Let's build three tabernacles. By the way, this is another proof against this re-emerging kind of thinking about reincarnation. Moses and Elijah returned as not cows or butterflies or someone else living in some other time. They returned as Moses and Elijah. And, interesting to me, Peter recognized them instantaneously. Had Peter met them before? No way. And we have no record of there being a formal introduction, Jesus saying, Peter, this is Moses. Moses, this is Peter. Elijah, Peter. Peter, Elijah. How do you do? How do you do? That wasn't happening. There was an instantaneous recognition. Wow, it's good for us to be here. Let's build three booths. One for you, Jesus, and for Moses, and for Elijah. There was an immediate recognition which tells me something about heaven. That when we get to heaven, we're going to recognize immediately everybody who has ever lived in history who is in heaven eternally. No need for name tags, folks. No forgetting of names. No need for introductions, man. It'll be happening instantaneously. Recognition. So often people ask me, tell me, are we going to know each other in heaven? That seems to concern a lot of people. Well, Matthew 17, I think, is proof that we will indeed know each other. Besides, we're not going to be stupider in heaven than we are here on earth. You know, if we know each other here, we'll know each other there, you bet. It's good for us to be here. While he yet spake, though, verse 5, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them. And behold, or as your newer translations render it, suddenly or interruptively, a voice out of the cloud which said, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Hear ye him." Peter, I'm going to interrupt you yet once again. God the Father speaks from the cloud over the mountain, "This is my beloved Son, hear ye him." When? Peter, you want to build three booths, one for Elijah, the prophets, one for Moses, the law, one for Jesus, your master. No, this is my Son. Listen to him, Peter. Nice try, but wrong again. In other words, you don't put the law and the prophets on the same pedestal as you put Jesus. This is my beloved Son. The purpose of Moses, who gave the law. The ministry of Elijah, who came in the power of the Spirit, was to prepare us for the coming of Jesus. They were preparers. They are not equivalent with Jesus. And I say this because you know what's happening in the Rogue Valley and across our country? There is a theology which is gaining popularity called plural covenants. And the theology of plural covenants says, now wait a minute, Jesus is salvation for the Gentiles. But if a Jewish person sincerely keeps the law to the best of their ability, or follows the message of the prophets with integrity, that you'll make it into the kingdom. There are many ways to get into the kingdom. That is, if you keep the Abrahamic covenant or the Mosaic covenant, or if you keep the new covenant, which is Jesus Christ, all of these covenants of the Bible are intact and they all lead into the kingdom. Why is this being taught? It's an attempt by people who love the Jews and Israel to try and figure out how can we get them into heaven apart from their belief in Jesus Christ. I understand the heart. Being a lover of Israel and one who journeys there frequently, I love that country. I love those people. They touch me deeply. And I understand how people would say, there's got to be a way to get them into the kingdom, even though they've rejected Jesus Christ. But it was a Jew, Peter himself, who said, there is no other name under heaven whereby men must be saved. The name Yeshua. Jesus. There is no other name. And so when you encounter these conversations with people here in the Rogue Valley who are saying, well, yes, Jesus is great, but if a Jew believes sincerely in the Torah and keeps Judaism as it was meant to be, they'll be in heaven too. Let's build three booths, three tabernacles, one for Jesus, one for the law, one for the prophets. What does God say? He interrupts Peter. This is my beloved Son. Hear ye him. One way. There is no other name under heaven. It's very simple. One way. No man cometh to the Father but by me, Jesus said. And so the Father interrupted Peter, and when the disciples, verse 6, heard it, this voice from heaven, they fell on their face and they were sore afraid. And Jesus came and touched them and said, arise, be not afraid. It's interesting. The voice of God always knocks people down. In humility, in brokenness. And the Word of God, Jesus Christ, is always coming and saying, arise, and picking them up. If I simply listen to the voice of God who thundered from Mount Sinai, the law, thou shalt not, ooh, I'm going down. Because I have broken the law. And the scriptures declare that if you break the law in one point, guess what? You break the entire thing. You're guilty of every point. When you hear the voice of God thundering from the mountain, you fall on your face, but then the Word of God, the Logos, Jesus comes and says, arise, be not afraid, for He has provided salvation for us. I'm so thankful for Jesus Christ, because I would still be on my face. So would you. We have a phrase, I fell flat on my face. Well, we did. And then comes Jesus and says, arise, be not afraid. He is our salvation, our propitiation. That is, He paid the price for our sin. Arise, be not afraid. And verse 8 is a classic. And when they had lifted up their eyes, they saw no man save Jesus only. Elijah, the power of the prophets. Moses, the intensity of the law, gone. Only they saw Jesus. That's the key. May the Lord give us nothing but eyes for Jesus. May we not try and keep the law. May we not try and follow the prophets, but realize that both the law and the prophets came simply to prepare the way for Jesus. And they looked and they saw none but Him. Now, let me explain to you what's happening here. The transfiguration, the metamorphosis, the shining, the glory of God shining through the deity of man. What does this mean, theologically? Why is this so critical and so important? Why is this holy ground? Why does Peter mention it in his epistles years later? We were eyewitnesses of His glory. What does this mean? What is happening here is this. It is a vindication, or should I say, an illustration, a verification, a validation that Jesus, for 33 years, being 33 at this time, moved through life flawlessly, perfectly, and now He's being transfigured. His glory is coming forth. He's shining beautifully. If back in the Garden of Eden, if Adam and Eve had never sinned, what would have happened? Would they have stayed in the Garden of Eden forever and ever? What about heaven? What was God's intention there? Had Adam and Eve not eaten of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, that forbidden fruit, had they not launched into a rebellion against God, would they have just cruised around that garden forever and ever, never dying? No. I'm convinced personally that planet Earth is simply a place of testing. And had Adam and Eve passed that test by not rebelling against God, not choosing to reject Him by eating of that fruit, that at a certain point they would have been transfigured. They would have begun to glow like Jesus here on Mount Hermon and would have been taken up into heaven. All right, you made it. You passed the test. You proved yourself that you love Me, the Father would say to Adam, to Eve, that you are not rebelling against Me, but you really do care about Me. You didn't get sucked into rebellion. You passed the test. Welcome, come on in to heaven. And this transfiguration would have took place, but instead of that, they rebelled. And they looked at each other and they suddenly knew that they were what? Naked. It would seem as though whatever glory they were experiencing at all initially suddenly dissipated in that moment of sin. And they were exposed and naked. And as a result, they were driven out of the garden. Humanity failed. Adam was our best bet, gang. He was the Mike Tyson of spirituality as far as humanity goes. I mean, if you were going to get in a ring against a pretty tough fighter, would you rather step in that ring yourself or have Mike Tyson represent you? For me, I would rather have Mike step in the ring and see what he could do. Well, let me tell you something. If you and I were in the Garden of Eden, we would have fallen long before Adam. He was the Mike Tyson of humanity. And he got knocked out. He went down. So we would have done no better. Mankind blew it. Here comes Jesus. Jesus, who is called by Paul the last Adam. He walks through life for 33 years, and guess what? He never sins. Tempted in all points as we are, yet without sin. He made it. And now he's on Mount Hermon, and suddenly he's shining, and these three disciples are seeing the glory of the kingdom, what could have happened, and he's shining and glowing. And at this point, I firmly believe, had Jesus chosen, he could have just launched right off that mountain up into heaven. And he could have said as he was going up, "Sorry, gang. I came and I showed you that it could have been done. That a man could have lived sinlessly. That man was not destined to sin and to damnation. But he could have, but you didn't. Starting with Adam and all of you, you failed. Oh, well, I showed you that it could have been done. So you can't condemn me or indict me for giving you an impossible task. I did it," Jesus could have said as he shot up the mountain and went into heaven. And at that point, the world could have been damned, rightly so, and God could not have been held accountable for being unfair, because Jesus showed us that it could have been done. But instead of launching off into heaven and saying, "Sorry, gang," what did he do? He came down that mountain. And the one who succeeded in life without sinning, just the opposite of Adam, who was driven from the garden, Jesus, the second Adam, or I should say the last Adam, went into the garden. What garden? The Garden of Gethsemane. Where he did what? He submitted to the will of the Father in dying for us, and he went up another mountain called Calvary. That's what's incredible about this story. He could have launched up into heaven and said, "Sorry, gang," but instead he came down off the mountain, went into another garden, Gethsemane, and finally up a hill called Calvary, where he died for our sins and paid the price. Not saying tough luck, he said, "Hey, I'll pay the price for your mistakes." Fantastic. Unbelievable, but it's true. And so Jesus, coming down from the mountain, verse 9, instead of launching up into heaven as he could have done, he came down from the mountain. And he charged them, saying, "Tell the vision to no man until the Son of Man be risen again from the dead." His disciples ask, "Why then say the scribes that Elijah must first come?" In Malachi chapter 4, the prophecy is Elijah would come before Messiah appeared. And they were saying, "Well, why is this teaching going around that Elijah would first come? Where is he? We see him on the mountain, but we haven't seen him come before you, not really." Jesus then answered verse 11 and said, "Elijah truly shall first come and restore all things. But I say to you that Elijah is come already, and they knew him not, but have done unto him whatsoever they listed. Likewise shall also the Son of Man suffer of them. Then the disciples understood that he spake unto them of John the Baptist. Elijah did come. John the Baptist came in the spirit and power of Elijah. Now, John was not Elijah. He came in the same spirit of Elijah. And Elijah is going to come again before Jesus' second coming. That's why Jesus said here, Elijah truly, verse 11, shall first come. But I say to you that Elijah has already come. That is, in the spirit, in the person of John the Baptist. John came in the spirit and power of Elijah. They understood that, verse 13 tells us. And when they were come to the multitude, there came to him a certain man, kneeling down to him and saying, Lord, have mercy on my son, for he is a lunatic. Maybe you might feel that way about your child. The idea here, though, is that he's really crazy, demonized. Some versions translate that epileptic. That's missing the point. The fact is that he was being demonized. The word lunatic actually means being smitten by the moon. In those cultures, they believed that if you were sleeping outside at night and the moon happened to shine on your face, it would drive you crazy. Thus, lunatic. And in the Psalms, the Lord is promising us that he will be a covering for us by night, protecting us, if you would, from insanity, using that cultural understanding, if you would. You're not going to be moonstruck. You're not going to go crazy. I'll be your protection. I'll keep you in sanity. But this fella here, his son was demonized, a lunatic, and vexed. For oftentimes, verse 15, he falls into the fire and oftentimes into the water. And I brought him to thy disciples, and they could not cure him. As Jesus comes down off the mountain, oh, my son, he's a lunatic, and he's jumping into the fire, and he's jumping into water. He's seeking to kill himself. He's demonized. We see in our day a rise in this whole phenomena of teenage suicide. Kids taking their lives, jumping into fire, if you would. I am convinced that the solution for teenage suicide is a recognition that it is a demonic problem, not a cultural problem. That Satan is a destroyer and seeks to invade our young people. In an article, you might have saw it in Woman's Day magazine. Well, you guys didn't see it probably. Again, these articles come out constantly. The Devil Made Me Do It, the story of Theron Reed Roland II, who killed James Michael Hardy and others. For many teenagers, Satan has become part of their daily life. Rock lyrics glorify him. Werewolves leer from t-shirts. Satanic symbols decorate jewelry. Some kids just want to shock adults. But for a disturbed many, the attraction to satanic ritual is great and deadly. This is not a Christian publication. It's Women's Day. And it describes the brutal deaths that are taking place among teens, both suicide and murder, and how it is definitely linked to satanic symbols and activities. Suddenly, satanic symbols seem to be as obvious a sign of today's youth as bobby socks were of another generation. The devil's symbols, upside-down crosses, pentagrams, which are five-pointed stars in the midst of a circle, the number 666 are the new graffiti on all high school walls. In any town, you can see teenagers with their fingernails painted black or wearing images of demons and werewolves on their t-shirts or dangling a devil's cross from one earlobe. Teenagers listen for an average of 4 to 6 hours a day to pulsating pop music, Some young people, like Pete and his friends, turn up the volume on lyrics that deal with blood and death and destruction. They signal each other with the devil's horns, a closed fist with the index finger and pinky raised. For some parents, Satan is a religious reality, the dark opposite of God. For others, seemingly a joke. And it talks about parental responsibility for ignoring the very obvious signs that kids are dabbling in Satanism. And then it goes ahead in a secular way and gives parents warning signs. Dr. Carl Roschk at the University of Denver gives this synopsis. Who gets involved? Most often, it's bright teenagers, bored and underachieving, looking for forbidden excitement. They are often and usually gifted, talented, and yet have a low self-worth. Often they're from troubled homes, or they have no strong moral or religious convictions. Teens are especially vulnerable at transition times, a divorce, an illness, a move to a new school or a new town. Watch for these signs, mood swings, avoiding family members, dropping old friends and activities such as sports teams, being unusually secretive about new friends, personality changes, particularly the loss of a sense of humor. That's interesting. An obsession with movies, videos, books, and records that have the themes of violence, rape, death, and demonism. Satanic symbols, pentagrams, inverted crosses, werewolves, demons, doodled in notebooks, worn as jewelry, used to decorate a room, drawn or tattooed on the body or the hand. Changes in eating or sleeping patterns. Erratic school grades. Cruelty to animals. What to do? Don't panic. They could signal a passing rebellion or a fleeting fad. Listen to your children's rock lyrics. If you're still concerned, check with the school. Perhaps a teacher or counselor has noticed something. Discuss it with your therapist or religious counselor. Well, the article goes on and on describing the reality of satanic demonic involvement by kids today. It's not just Christians and preachers that are saying this. It's being written about in all major magazines. There's something happening out there. Propagated on MTV. Seen on the walls of school in graffiti. And yet, even though they are correct in their observation, man, they're out to lunch on their solution. Their solution? Don't be too concerned. It could be a passing fad. Hey, if those things show up in your house, deal with it quickly and directly and definitely. It must have no place in our homes at all. Whether in posters, in pictures, or on records, tapes, or on the television screen, it must have no entry whatsoever. None. You're playing with fire. That's what this lunatic boy found. It's not a passing fad. It's not something which should be taken lightly. 100,000 teens have taken their lives already in the past couple of years. And many, many more thousands, perhaps five times that number, have attempted in the last year alone. We've seen that in our own valley. The tragedy of teenage suicide. I walked into a room where a young man blew his brains out. Scattered on the walls. Tragedy. Heartbreaking situation. Would to God that the parents had taken seriously the signs that were obvious. The graffiti, the music, the t-shirts, the posters. too late. This dad in our story realized his son was in trouble. There's something bizarre going on. He brought the boy to the disciples because at this time Jesus was on the mountain being transfigured. Only three disciples were with Jesus. The other nine were evidently down at the base of the mountain. And those disciples could do nothing. Maybe you feel like you're not able to do anything about your home situation. Master, I brought my boy here, but your disciples were unable to do anything. I appreciate this father because he didn't give up even though the disciples of Jesus were unable to help. So often people say, well, I give up. I took my kid to see this therapist or that counselor. I took him to see that minister or that pastor and nothing's happening. I just give up. This dad didn't. Blessings be upon him. He didn't say, well, thanks, guys, you tried. I guess there's nothing we can do. We'll just sort of wait it out. But he waited for the master to come down. He was determined to take his son to the master. Jesus, verse 17, answered and said, oh, faithless and perverse generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I suffer with you? Bring him to me. Oh, faithless generation, Jesus would say in our day, how long? How long will it be till you bring him to me? Bring him to me. That's what Jesus would say today. Not to counseling, not to therapy, not to drug programs. Bring him to me. Mom, you have that responsibility. Dad, that's a mandate upon you tonight, definitely. Bring your child, your son, your daughter, your teenager to Jesus. Pray for him constantly. Talk to him continually. Bring him to fellowship regularly. Bring them to Jesus. That's the key. Bring him to me. Oh, faithless and perverse generation. That's the heart of Jesus to our nation. How long? How many must die? How much darkness must come? How long does this have to go on before you see the problem is not trying to deal with the drug lords in Colombia? Or banning music through legislation. That's not going to be the solution. It's when we bring our kids to Jesus. When you, Dad, and you, Mom, are faithful in intercession, in instruction, and in the obligation to bring your kids where they're going to be around brothers and sisters. Not an option. Bring them to me. And Jesus then, verse 18, rebuked the devil. And that devil departed out of him, and the child was cured from that very hour. Well, then his disciples came to Jesus apart and said, well, why could not we cast him out? Jesus said, verse 20, because of your unbelief. For verily I say to you, if you have faith even as the grain of a mustard seed, and say, notice again that articulation going on record, say to this mountain, remove thence to yonder place, it shall remove. And nothing shall be impossible to you. Why couldn't you do it? Because of a lack of faith. If you would have believed in your heart and spoken through your mouth and expected things to happen, man, mountains would be moved. The landscape would be changed. But without faith, it is impossible to please him. Then Jesus gets to the heart of the issue in verse 21. Howbeit, this kind goeth not out but by prayer and fasting. It's a tough battle. This demon that has entered into your son. This is not something which is lightweight or easy. This does not go out except by faith that comes via prayer and fasting. Would you mark this, mom and dad, and please be aware of this teaching? Prayer and fasting. Grandpa, remember this when your grandson or your granddaughter is in trouble. Prayer and fasting. Prayer. Attaching to God. Prayer attaches us to God. Fasting, detaching us from the flesh. There's this beautiful combination. I'm detaching from the flesh. I'm attaching to my Father. Prayer and fasting. Attaching, detaching. I'll give up that burger for today and I'll pray for my son or my granddaughter. I'll pray that my faith might well up within me, that I might then speak to the mountain, be removed, that I might believe that God is going to be working and things will happen. Now, here's what interests me. Those disciples, no doubt, would be thinking, this kind does not go out but by prayer and fasting. How were we to know that we were going to have this encounter? We didn't have time for fasting or prayer. We didn't know that we were going to be faced with a lunatic. That's the point. It is calling upon a lifestyle of praying and fasting, not an emergency session of prayer and fasting. They should have been praying and fasting all along so that when the lunatic showed up, they could have spoken the word of faith and there could have been deliverance and salvation. You see, maybe you're sitting here smugly, perhaps, saying, well, man, I'm glad my son or my daughter or my grandson or my granddaughter. No problem. Please be wiser than that. God help us. Because we do not know the battles that they're facing. The strategy of the enemy being plotted in the boardroom of hell for our children, for our loved ones. Satan is a master strategizer, and he deals specifically with people, subtly, diabolically, and at the right time he invades, perhaps even unexpectedly, into the lives of our loved ones. And if I hear Jesus right at this point, there's a word of instruction saying it's really too late to pray and fast when the emergency is before you. You need to be developing a life of praying and fasting so that when the problem surfaces, you're already ready. It should be part of your life, even when things are going good. If things are going well in your family, rejoice and prepare. Praying and fasting should be a part of your spiritual discipline, part of your lifestyle, because you don't know what tomorrow holds. Praying, attaching ourselves to the Father, fasting, detaching from the world, saying, I care about my family. I think of Brother Job in the Old Testament. You know what he did? Every morning he got up and he sacrificed an ox for each one of his kids. That was before food processors. I mean, he had to get out there and hack away and cut up and lay out. It was a lot of work. But what did he say in chapter 1 of Job? He said, I'm doing this, praying for my kids, sacrificing on behalf of my kids, lest today they should fall into temptation and fall into sin. What a glorious privilege we have as parents. We don't have to just say, I hope they don't get sucked into drugs or into demonic activity or into this or that or the other. We have opportunity in victory to say, I'm going to seek my Father, praying and fasting and believing that there is going to be deliverance, and I'm going to take my child to Jesus constantly. One more suggestion here before we leave this point. Why weren't they praying and fasting? Could I suggest to you a thought? I think they were jealous. I really do. They had let down their guard. Oh, yeah. How come it's always Peter, James, and John? That's a clique. Jesus has favorites. How come they're the guys that always get to see the miracles happening? Why should I bother praying? I mean, Jesus has his favorites. He always takes Peter, James, and John up on the mountain, and it's not me, and that's the inner core, that's the clique, that's the gang, that's the group. And that mentality can creep into me, into you very easily, if we're not so careful. Oh, the Lord isn't using me. I'm not fitting into the great scope of international ministry. Why should I bother to pray and fast? And I suggest that they let down their guard. They were hanging out at the bottom of the mountain, perhaps grumbling and complaining. How come it's always Peter, James, and John? Maybe you feel from time to time, why aren't you using me, Lord? I mean, it seems like you use this gal and that guy and the other person and never me. And if you're not careful, that's the time when you stop praying, stop fasting. You feel like, well, I'm not being used. My life isn't that significant, not that important. And then the moment comes. The moment comes when you need the power of the Spirit, faith in your heart, weaponry for warfare, and you come up empty. I was third string quarterback for the Santa Clara County Hornets, that team that I told you about a while ago. The team that won the national championship the year before I got there. They played back in Pennsylvania, won the whole thing. When I showed up on the scene, that year we were 2-9. 2 wins, 9 losses. And as a seventh grader on that Pop Warner football team, I was playing a defensive safety, and then I was also third string quarterback. And I thought, you know, I'm never going to get in. I mean, and so I didn't really prepare taking snaps like my coach told me to. That is taking hikes from the center, getting that rhythm down. Well, sure enough, against San Bruno, Cliff Backage, he went down. He was our first string quarterback. Got a broken arm or something. Steve Buring, the second string quarterback, sprained his ankle. I can still hear Coach Bennett. Corson, you're in. That was the last thing in the world I expected. And at that time, Pop Warner in California, where it was pretty big stuff. We didn't have junior high school teams. Pop Warner was the only tackle thing happening. And so, you know, a lot of folks were there, relatively speaking, and I got underneath that center, and guess what? I dropped the snap 5 times in a row. 5 out of 5. True. I never played quarterback again. Not once. Coach Bennett put in somebody who never played quarterback to get in there and take the snaps and run the team. Why? I wasn't prepared. I didn't think I'd ever get called on. I really didn't think. I mean, these two other guys were so far ahead of me and they were such good QBs, I thought I'll never get called on. So when the moment came, the opportunity was there, the challenge was before me, I fumbled. Just like these guys. You don't know when the challenge is going to be before you on behalf of your own family or some other need of ministry. You don't know. That's what Jesus is saying. Howbeit, this kind does not come out except by prayer and fasting. In other words, you should be living a life of prayer and fasting because you never know what's around the corner. When the coach is going to call you in and say, hey, you're QB. Well, while they abode in Galilee, verse 22, Jesus said unto them, the Son of Man shall be betrayed into the hands of men. They shall kill him. The third day he shall be raised again. This next phrase intrigues me. They were exceedingly sorry. Why? They only heard part of the story. They heard the part about him saying that he shall be betrayed and killed. But he said, the third day I'll be raised again. They didn't hear that. All they heard was death, betrayal, tragedy. Kind of like us, I think. I really do. When someone dies, my first reaction so often is always deep, deep grief and sorrow. And that's understandable. And yet, that's only part of the story, isn't it? If that person knows the Lord, they are now with the Lord. We're just like these guys. You might think, well, how could they have been so dumb? I mean, here he says he's going to be killed but rise again, and they were exceedingly sorry. How could we be so dumb? When somebody goes on to be with the Lord, you see, oh yes, we miss them and grieve over our loss. But the full story is, they're in heaven. They're there, where we crave to be. And then in verse 24, an interesting little miracle that only Matthew records. Chapter 17 is so heavy, talking about the transfiguration, talking about the deliverance from this son who was demonized, prayer and fasting, the impending crucifixion and resurrection. And now there's this light-hearted little miracle concerning a fish and a coin and Peter. And only Matthew records it. There's a reason for that. Only Matthew deals with this miracle. And it's very interesting. And we'll talk about it in our next study together. Shall we stand? As we stand before the Lord, and I'm going to ask, please, no one move unless you absolutely have to. I want us to consider this holy ground. To me, the Transfiguration is one of the most incredible, special stories in all of the Gospels. Because when I meditate upon it and I realize that Jesus had every right to launch up into heaven, but instead came down and died for me, for me, it really touches my heart. Jesus, that you would do that for a person like, I know who I am. I know what I am. And if I was him, I wouldn't have done it. If I was Jesus, I would have launched up into heaven and said, John, see, I showed you how to do it, how it could have been done, but you didn't. Sorry. But Jesus died for us. Came down that mount and up another mount called Calvary. Would you give a moment, please, to the Lord and allow that to settle into your heart? The goodness of Jesus
His incredible loving kindness. I'm going to ask you to bow your head. I'm going to ask, Rick, are you here? Is Rick here? If you would come and share that song with us. And let's just bow our heads and consider as Rick shares in a contemplative song about that event.
Peter, James, and John followed Jesus up the hill to a mountain where he began to shine. As they beheld his glory, two men appeared to them, Moses and Elijah, walking right back into time. A cloud overcame them, and a voice from above, saying, "This is my beloved Son, whom I dearly love." And Jesus came and touched them, and said to them, "Arise, be not afraid." When they lifted up their eyes, they saw no man save Jesus only. They inquired of none save Jesus only. And they followed none save Jesus only, as they traveled down the mountain with him. Another father met them as they came down the hill with a son who was sick and in despair. As our Savior touched him, the boy was made whole. As Jesus cared for him in fasting and in prayer, he saw no man save Jesus only. They inquired of none save Jesus only. And they followed none save Jesus only, as they traveled along with him. Another hill our Savior was willing to ascend, with crosses and criminals to die. Jesus was to tell them how he would be killed, betrayed in the hands of men, on the third day to arise. He saw no man save Jesus only. They inquired of none save Jesus only. And they followed none save Jesus only, as they traveled down